welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature Captain America, the first Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And we are the legendary Order 66. We're under orders of covering Minute 66.
Wrong movie.
Yeah, that's
wrong
true.
Wrong franchise.
It's all in the same boat now, though. Lots of action, rip-roaring adventure things going on here. Hal, pick us up on the 66th minute here of what's going down.
All right. Well, we pick up right where we left off at the end of minute 65. It's funny how that works. But here we go. Explosions erupt through the Hydra factory as countdown clocks in the control room reach zero, sending shockwaves through the structure, flames licking at the walls. Steve Rogers, supporting a weakened Bucky Barnes, navigates the trembling catwalks toward the control room bridge. On the opposite side, Johann Schmidt stands with Dr. Zola behind him, his voice dripping with mockery. Captain America, how exciting! Schmidt steps onto the bridge, closing the distance. I am a great fan of your films. So Dr. Erskine managed it after all. Not exactly an improvement, but still impressive. Steve, unflinching, swings a fist, connecting with Schmidt's jaw. Schmidt rubs his face, unfazed. You've got no idea, says Steve. Haven't I? Schmidt retorts, throwing a powerful punch. Steve raises his shield, but the blow dents the metal with a fist-shaped imprint. Steve draws his pistol, but Schmidt swats it from his hand. The gun skitters off the bridge, clattering into the abyss below. Steve stumbles, landing on the grating. Schmidt advances, his face oddly stretched, a red mark blooming under one eye. Steve, seizing the moment, kicks out, sending Schmidt reeling to the far side of the bridge. Zola, eyes wide with alarm, grabs a large lever at the bridge's edge.
How handy is there a lever in the middle of all this?
Despite all the OSHA violations.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, exactly. At least, unlike the Empire... they do have railings.
There are some railings.
You won't be falling into nothing bigger than a gun will fall into the abyss. All I could think of with this was the Emperor's New Groove, the movie from Disney film from 2000, where Kronk would always grab the wrong lever and Yzma would always be saying, "Pull the lever, Kronk! Wrong lever!" And that's like the most quotable thing out of that movie was, why do we even have that lever? it's such a great moment. And you know, where there's a lever, there's always a wrong lever.
But that was a better movie than people remember. I really love that movie.
Yeah, it's worth a rewatch. Just to, you know, it's your mind and memory can play tricks on you about how a movie was good or bad. And I think it didn't get the attention that it deserved.
I agree.
That's typical of a lot of Disney movies, as Hal and I were with The Rocketeer.
So, yes, indeed.
But yeah.
Another great one.
Yeah, yeah. It's
So I wouldn't mind starting out, gents, you know, because this is a great minute of this movie. The entire movie's been building to this moment of meeting and conflict between Steve and the Red Skull. And my God, it's got explosions and flames and action. It reminded me very much of a couple of references. One is Gandalf versus the Balrog, and and the other one that left immediately mind was Captain Kirk versus the Klingon Captain Kruge in Star Trek III, where they're fighting to the death over the erupting Genesis planet.
Yes, thrilling, isn't it? Yeah.
And you know, it's just you get these two characters who spent the whole movie, you know, opposing each other from a distance, and now they're face to face. And it's just, to me, this is one of the turning points, one of the linchpins of this whole film.
Yeah, the thought I had in mind, another scene that clicked for me was Obi-Wan and Darth Maul in The Phantom Menace, when Darth Maul had just defeated Qui-Gon, and there's nothing Obi-Wan can do because he's separated from I guess this is kind of leading into the next minute, but it's like they want to fight, but they can't fight. And Zola's about to create that situation.
That's a great reference. I agree with that. That's
And
terrific.
I already hate myself for even considering pointing out that Darth Maul also, in fact, had a largely red skull. And with that, good night, everybody.
No,
I'll
no.
see myself out. But it is interesting that these two, of course, they're pretty equally matched, but we're starting to see, almost literally the chink in Schmidt's armor as we're seeing the bits of red showing through and the makeup starting to give.
Yeah, it's so subtly nicely done because, we who've read the comics understand what's under that mask. And if we were paying attention earlier in the film to the portrait painter with all the red all over his palette, we know what's under that mask. But I don't know if someone coming to the movie cold or, a civilian, an innocent, would really catch what's going on there yet. But just the way his face is starting to disintegrate is very effective and creepy.
Yeah, and it's telling the people that don't know that if you have no other idea, okay, we know he's strong. He seems to be about as strong as Captain America, and there's something else going on with his face, and as you said, it's creepy and it's intriguing.
Yeah, I do like the mix of, obviously some of this is special effects, green screens and miniatures, but it's a nice there's a beautiful forced perspective scene in the stairway at the beginning, because there is a large archway that forms in the foreground, and it gives you an idea of the scale, the depth of it. But obviously, if you know films, this is a forced perspective where they've put a miniature up close to give you the idea that they are way in the back of this massive factory. And it's a beautiful, I mean, it's a simple conceit to do in filmmaking, but it's amazing how much it sells the area, the volume that you're looking at.
Yeah.
And
And it
it
almost
still
doesn't
works.
matter these days. Yeah, it still works. I was just going to say, it almost doesn't matter if it's a physical model on set or if they did it digitally, because it's the same principle of guiding the eye and fooling the eye to accept this reality that's not real.
And that also that cartoon idea of when Schmidt throws that punch and you see a fist shape appear in Captain America's brass shield, that it's like that's something out of a cartoon. You
Yeah,
actually see a
right.
perfect imprint.
But it tells you immediately how strong Schmidt is. It tells without words, we know, oh my God, this guy's got a punch.
And it's got forgive the pun, but it's got so much more impact because we're sort of we're used to that in cartoons, but now we sort of see it happening in what looks does it looks perfectly real, and you find yourself thinking, wow, so that's really what that old thing would look like.
Yeah, it's definitely a Roadrunner Coyote moment, like when
Yes.
the coyote walks away the shape of an anvil or something,
Yes, exactly.
or the cliff gets the coyote shaped outline where he smacked into it.
It definitely relies on its comic heritage. I was wondering, now he's got, I guess this takes one of those flags off the board. But does Zola, I mean, and Zola considers this their retreating, but to Red Skull, I think this just means, well, it's just part of the game. We're gonna, it's like giving up a pawn. I don't think he's, even though he's looking around and he's just told Zola a couple of minutes ago that he's got to get the workers to work harder to make more stuff. But this, even though it seems like a massive setback, it's not that big a deal. He's got the Tesseract with him, so he can just go do it at factory number two or three or wherever he's landing.
Yeah, very
Yeah,
much
it's
so.
like we were talking about in the last episode or the last two episodes. He's just he's very logical about this. And I think Jim, your chess analogy, I think was quite good in that this is how this part of this game has gone. And let's not dwell on it or spend a lot of time in self-pity. We just got to move on to the next thing.
Yeah, I was wondering about how Schmidt reacted to the punch, because he was doing that very mocking thing about, yeah, I like your movies, you're not real, but it's nice to see, and you're not much of a threat to me, but who cares.
Basically
And
calling him a chorus girl again.
he'd go out with the colonel, have drinks and talk about what a ridiculous thing Captain America is. But I keep wondering if Schmidt thought getting punched was rude of Captain America. That he seemed to like, well, I can show you that I can be just like you, and if you want to play it that way, or we could sit here and trade barbs.
Yes, it seemed a
Interesting.
bit uncivilized.
It, my take on it though was Schmidt was just thinking, all right, here we go. Here we go. This is going to be interesting, you know?
No.
So.
You know, a thing that I hadn't thought of until we were discussing recent episodes about, you know, Zola's departure. You know, we see him running down the hall, and we're all in very much in agreement that, you know, Zola is looking out for Zola, and he's taking with him whatever he might need depending on where he lands. So even without thinking about that much of it that way, that far through, when I first saw this, I was even a little surprised then that all of a sudden sort of Zola and Schmidt are there together, and Schmidt is handing him the case. And I'm not saying it's like a discontinuity or anything. We can easily infer what happened, that, you know, Zola may have been running in whatever direction, but he and Schmidt met up and said, "Oh, okay, boss. Yeah, I'm coming with you. Let's go." But I still think that in the back of his mind, he was licking his finger and holding it up to see which way the wind was blowing.
Absolutely. Oh, boss, I was just looking for you. Let's go,
Yes,
buddy.
exactly. Oh, here, let me hold that tesseract for you, so you can go
Yeah,
punch
I
the other
agree.
guy.
It is a little, maybe it's an inconsistency here. Maybe we're just reading Zola wrong. Maybe he's more loyal to Schmidt than we thought, than I think. But yeah, it's interesting that we see him basically skittering away like a coward, and then he turns up
Right.
beside Schmidt's side facing Captain America. Still a coward, but
Right.
yeah.
Well, and I think he'd be so I mean he'd be so ineffective at doing, I mean, he can't do anything to Schmidt slash Red Skull. So obviously, as soon as he sees him, then okay, it's back to playing the role of number two toady and going on
Yeah,
from there.
I think the dynamic there between those two is each thinks the other one is the brains of the outfit. Zola has all the plans and things, and he sees Schmidt as a means to put all of his plans into operation, and Schmidt looks at Zola as his flying monkey. He get this. They each think the other one's going to get stuff done for them for their betterment. Not that they're not their mutual aid, but they can exploit each other. And
I kind of think I just this occurred to me, but I kind of think of Schmidt as the theoretical physicist and Zola as the practical engineer who gets that stuff done. Schmidt's got the big ideas, but if you want to actually build yourself a blue ray shooting cannon, Zola's your guy.
Yeah, it's they're not like I was picturing the great race with Professor Fate and Max.
Yes.
It's that Jack Lemmon and Peter Falk. Although I don't see Zola as a Peter Falk type. Peter Falk doesn't know which button to push when it's Max push the button. So it's
But he does know that one more thing.
yeah, that's true. The
Yep.
worlds collide. But yeah, go
Go
ahead.
ahead,
No,
please.
I'm fine. No, I'll
No,
stay.
really, after
I
you,
was gonna
immediately.
I
No,
was gonna
fine.
veer into to the language of filmmaking and so forth and cinematography. I noted that until this point, the entire factory has had a very bluish tinged palette, sort of implying where it's lit by moonlight. I complained in a previous episode that doesn't this place have any light bulbs? But it's all got this dim blue glow, and the moment the explosion starts, the palette changes immediately from that moonlight blue to this, bright golden brown coming up from the moonlight blue is coming from above, the golden brown's coming from below where the explosions are. And the effect of that, I noticed, really makes the red, white, and blue of Captain America's shield stand out. That shield is the only thing that shows those colors. It just brightly like a beacon in this entire sequence. The rest of everything else in the place, including Steve's clothing, the Red Skull's clothing, everybody's clothes, it's sort of a more of a muddy ochre brown than anything else. But that red, white, and blue shield, man, it's like as I said, like a beacon.
And the sustained flames. There's flames, but nothing smoking there. I mean, it's definitely movie flames, much like In Titanic, when you're seeing the furnace room breaking down and things, and you're seeing flames appearing, or the Towering Inferno, or Die Hard, you never see any smoke. It's all everything has to be lit by even colored orange yellow flames, and I think that kind of signals to the audience the colors of danger.
Yes.
You can't have a smoky room, especially if they're on the roof of a warehouse building, unless it's the Hindenburg or something. There's really no there should be lots of smoke up there, but in movie, as you were saying, movie shorthand, the flames indicate danger zone, red alert, that kind of thing.
Yeah, really, I mean, in this moment, the whole palette shifts, the light sources all shift. We've almost passed into a different world of danger and excitement.
Right. It's interesting though, but I think Brian, your point about how the colors of the shield stand out, like everything else, in the whole scene, once the fires start, is that very narrow range of colors, and I would describe the palette as almost being kind of compressed, except for that shield that stands out. But there's the difference between all of this warmth, and I don't mean that literally because of the fire, but the warm colors versus the cold ones. Like, to me, as soon as we see Steve lit that way, he suddenly strikes me as being it's more triumphant and more heroic. So there's the threat of the danger, but it's also, I don't want to say it's more flattering for Chris Evans, but it gives him that extra weight of of, to me, of power and clarity. Like, when the palette is blue and dark, we're largely sneaking around. But now it's warm and bright, and the quote unquote lights are on, and the I don't know, the gloves are off, even though they really aren't. But anyway.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, you can almost hear the trumpets blaring. He looks like a giant bronze statue almost,
Yeah, and whereas Red Skull is coming off as a demon, and he's obviously going to, we all are aware. I mean, I'm not giving anything away in the future that. Obviously, that Red Skull is going to go into the famous trope of "You and I are much alike," the Belloc speech, that he's going to be trying to turn him toward the dark side, and here, these yellow, the yellow and red, that these demonic temptations that Captain America is going to face, ridiculous as they are for Captain America, it's still one of those things you got to cross off in the movie list of the bad guy trying to convince the good guy that he should be a bad guy too. It's interesting that Joe can still, direct a movie that it still seems fresh. It doesn't, you know where it's going. If you've watched any adventure action movies in your life, you'll know where the story is going to go. But he still makes it, he still gives you the idea that, well, maybe there is something that's going to happen that's going to be slightly different from what we were expecting.
Well, to be fair to Joe, they don't waste a lot of time on it because we all know Captain America is not turning to the dark side any more than Luke Skywalker would,
It's still intriguing that he will pl he can it's still intriguing that Joe can play with that overused theme and get away with it.
Well, it really is it's the dark side meeting the light side. It's they're both in Star Wars terms, they're both expert users of the Force. They've got the same power set, and it's Obi-Wan versus Darth Vader, or as you said, Darth Maul versus young Obi-Wan. It's these evenly matched antagonists finally meeting.
But the whole story, of course, is, I mean, it's full of a series of tropes, and the young man with the mentor that he loses, and the journey, and the developing love interests, all those things we've seen before, and not to mention the fact that it's based on, property that at the time was what, 70 years old, something like that. So the story's out there. So it's a real testament to Joe and to the screenwriters, and I think everybody involved, that, as you said, it feels absolutely fresh and exciting, even if, if you played a few minutes of the film and then paused it for somebody who'd never seen it, but they'd seen a lot of films, and forced them to make some notes about what they thought might happen. Well, Captain America is probably going to defeat the bad guy and, and make a big
Yeah.
difference in World War II, and we know from the beginning he's probably going to get frozen at the end. So, you could sketch it out. But it's fascinating, as you guys have pointed out, that Joe and his team did such a good job with this that not only it feels fresh, but you can keep watching it. It's very
Yeah.
rewatchable. And so often now, with so many sort of rehashes and reboots and sequels and things like that that do get tiresome, like I find that as a viewer, as a consumer, one of my highest standards is, did this story surprise me in some way, or did I come out and say, well, I could have written that, and
Yeah.
by no means could I have written this, but as I say, just to be able to take something that does follow a generally predicted path and make it fun from start to finish.
Well, there's a lot of entertainment value in a comfortable story too, something that
Sure.
kind of fits you like a cozy sweater, and it doesn't have to surprise you. It just has to do it well, you know. You can do it poorly or you can do it well. This movie did it very, very well. But I'm with you, Hal. Man, when I see something in a movie I've never seen before, I'm a fan of that movie for life. Even if I don't even
Yes.
necessarily like it, it's just I did
Right.
not see that coming. If I can say I did not see that coming, I'm excited, and I support that art.
Hear, hear.
Yeah, it's great. Wow. Well, this has been a very fun. I mean, the next couple of minutes get really exciting, and I mean, I love the stakes that are going to be coming up through the next couple of minutes. Well, I like the rest of the movie, but the next couple of minutes we're going to have a bunch to talk about. So, but if you'd like to continue the conversation we're having here, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And please be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.